Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Suicide. How can we help veterans considering this permanent solution to a temporary problem? Today we hear stories about what it's like when they come home from war.
I couldn't find anything meaningful, and then I was like still stuck in Afghanistan, I guess.
Yeah, just kind of like wading through mud.
Exactly.
For some veterans, their experiences in war taught them what it means to support their fellow soldiers.
We learned that we only had each other to depend on, and we realized how important that was when we left.
This week on Inside Appalachia, stories from veterans and the invisible scars they bring home from active duty. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. A soldier from Wheeling, West Virginia, Damian Gavis, deployed to Afghanistan in 2012. And at first, things were going pretty smoothly.
Our whole battalion deployed with 3rd Special Forces Group as uplift squads in village stability operations, which means basically a dream deployment for any regular army.
He accompanied Special Forces to rural towns to build relationships with local leaders. But then one day, Damien's world turned upside down.
Towards the end of the deployment, we were in the Kapisa province, and it's kind of near Bagram. This is a place where we had thought was white space, which is basically a spot that you think that you aren't going to get hit at all, which we had been the whole deployment. We hadn't been hit there ever. And this white Corolla comes up around the bend, and I think, like, this guy's going to freaking hit me. And we're driving in the middle of the road, which is what you're supposed to do. And then I think he hits me, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, he hit me. And then like, I'm on fire. and I was John Wayne in it. I had my helmet unbuckled, and helmet blew off. My eyeglasses on, they blew apart, and my hair was burning. I like stuck my hands in my face, and I was like, I thought this is it. Like, this is where it goes down. Yeah. So, and I thought of my wife at the time, and I mean, it was in an instant. And I put my face up like this, and the only scar I had from that is right here. Is a little shrapnel got me, but I got burned pretty bad.
On the outside, the explosion left one tiny scar, but on the inside, it left a mark on Damien that still hasn't healed. Emotional trauma isn't like a missing leg. As civilians, we can't see it. But it leaves scars all the same, invisible ones. And they stay long after our veterans come home from active duty. The military calls their return to civilian life reintegration, and vets today experience it differently than former veterans did 70 years ago. Here's Damian talking with his friend and fellow veteran Mark Combs. We'll have more on him in a bit.
World War II veterans, they saw some ish. And they, like, way worse stuff than we'll ever see. The global war on terror veteran, I mean, maybe not, whatever, it's all relative. But when they came back, there was no reintegration. They came back on a boat. It took like a month to get home. And you know what they did? They BS'd with their buddies over what they just done, laughed about it, wept about it maybe. They processed it. Mm-hmm. They had a soft place to land, someone like them. Maybe they talked to a chaplain, who knows, but they processed that event. You know, coming back on a plane.
Soldiers returning home from combat do go through what's called soldier readiness processing, or SRP. It can take a few days to be evaluated and go through debriefing before they're sent home to their family.
Yeah, you're there in a day.
Yep.
You don't have time to take that journey of healing.
Yep. I mean, in reintegration, like, you're going to blow past that just so you can get laid and get drunk. I mean, dead serious.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's what drives it. You got to be honest about it.
Yeah. Encouraging a discourse between veterans is probably, between veterans and professionals, just is probably, that's the easiest thing. Like, you've got to talk about it. You've got to put your ego away as much as it hurts and talk about it. I mean, it doesn't make you any less of a man or woman.
So that's what we're doing on today's show. We're going to talk with vets themselves, with medical professionals, and with the VA. We'll hear vets talk about what they need and what they're not getting, where they're finding solace and peace, and what still haunts them. That's ahead here on Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
The numbers on veteran suicide are staggering. A 2012 study from the VA found that 22 veterans a day took their own lives. Today, that number is just slightly over 20 a day, according to the latest report from the VA. On this show, we're bringing you the faces and voices behind that number. These are stories of veterans who can help us see their invisible scars. We're getting help today from Army veteran Mark Combs, who grew up in Sophia, West Virginia. Mark recently hosted a one-hour documentary called Still Taking Casualties. He interviewed vets who had tried to take their own lives. The show was meant to raise awareness about the problem. Next, we'll hear Mark talk with Corporal Christopher Morris.
I was United States Marine Corps, deployed to Afghanistan May of 2009. Basically what I did was QRF, which is Quick Reaction Force, but I was recovery specialist. So if somebody got blown up, we were the ones that went out to go get them. So essentially it's just rolling into a minefield every day.
Christopher comes from a family of soldiers in the Army. He was the first Marine in his family. He was wounded in 2009 in Afghanistan.
It was a pressure plate IED, went off underneath my butt, got a TBI, head and neck, you know, twisted around, the shoulder went where the shoulder was.
TBI stands for traumatic brain injury. Christopher speaks highly of the caregivers at Camp Lejeune who helped to put him on a road to recovery once he was back stateside. But that road was still a long one. He eventually received a medical retirement from the Marine Corps in 2011 and started school at WVU the following year. He says that when he got to Morgantown, he found a college community and culture focused on socializing and drinking. It made the transition and even graduation difficult. Around that time, he lost his roommate, a veteran, to suicide. It seemed to come out of the blue.
He was extremely happy with the football game. We were watching the Eagles beat the Colts by a field goal with 3 seconds left. 10 minutes later, you know, 9 mil pop.
So there was like no prior
indication? Absolutely nothing.
Just out of nowhere?
I didn't even see the suicide note until after they got him out. The cops ended up dusting, you know, my fingerprints for the gun residue. I gave them, you know, my clothes and things of that nature. And that's whenever they seen the suicide note.
And how's that been for you since then?
It definitely brings back a whole lot of things whenever, you know, you run out. And I'm not going to go into too much detail because I don't want the chance of his mom seeing it. You know, and I don't give out details of that, just for that reason. But it's brought back a lot of bad memories.
Christopher reached out to the VA, but so far many of his experiences have fallen short of being what he considers helpful.
Me and the VA just don't kind of get along. There are a lot of really great people. They have the best of intentions, and it's not the problem that they don't mean well. I mean, they have the best intentions. It's just the system itself so flawed. They're so behind the curve that they just don't know how to deal, you know, with us.
Again, that was Christopher Morris, a veteran who was wounded while serving in Afghanistan. This year, the VA released a new report about veteran suicides, looking at millions of veterans' records from the last 3 decades. Robert Bossart is a researcher who helped compile this report through the VA Suicide Prevention Office. He says that while the 22-a-day number helps grab the attention of the general public, it's not necessarily the most useful to researchers like him who are trying to understand more about why veterans take their own lives.
Something like 22 a day in and of itself is very difficult to use as an indicator of burden or change.
Just after this interview was recorded, the VA released a new report that shows this rate is now 20 veterans a day. So it may be decreasing a bit, though it's still quite high.
To understand that, it's really important to be able to put that in context of larger national trends and, of course, be able to understand changes among very important subgroups.
Bossart says that when you look at the data, there are at least four subgroups of veterans who seem to be of a higher risk of suicide. A majority of veterans who committed suicide were 50 or older. At the same time, there's been an increase in suicide among younger veterans between 18 to 29 years old. About 30% of those who died by suicide went to a VA hospital or clinic in the year of or before their death, about 6 out of 20 veterans. And finally, female veterans also make up one of the subgroups that Bossart and his team are studying.
So rates of suicide among women veterans have had remained relatively stable but relatively comparatively high over the past time period, so we need to better understand the characteristics of suicide among women veterans.
Women also suffer from a high rate of sexual assault in the military. In this next interview, we'll hear from a female vet whose experiences on base during wartime put her on a path towards self-destruction. Sarah Leifheit is from Wheeling, West Virginia, and was a sergeant in the United States Army. During her 12 years in service, she deployed twice, first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. Sarah completed her Bachelor of Arts in Psychology and is working on her Master's in Clinical Social Work from Boston University. Here's Sarah talking with WVU graduate and Raleigh County, West Virginia native, Mark Combs.
I know one cool thing about your deployment.
Oh, gosh.
You got a picture with Robin Williams.
I do, and it's on my wall at my house.
Yeah.
I was pretty sad when he took his own life.
Right.
That hit me harder than what I could ever imagine.
Right.
Because I'm like, if this dude couldn't make it, what chance do I have?
Tell us about Sarah's Army. Tell us about your deployments.
I landed in Afghanistan September 11th, 2002. And I remember that day, and I'm just remember thinking, the shit's about to hit the fan. Because it was the anniversary and everything else like that. And I land in Afghanistan in Bagram, and Bagram was like a mile long, and right. It was just barbed wire everywhere. And I was 18 at the time. I was young.
Sarah was an ammunition specialist, so anything that needed doing with ammo, Sarah got it done. Even though it was a hard job, she liked it. But at least one challenge of the job came as a complete surprise.
My first one, I was raped by a Navy intelligence officer. I don't know his name. He was somebody that would smoke outside our tent all the time. And I came home, and I was so young. And I remember coming home, and my behaviors were just crazy. I would do outrageous things. Even though I was underage, I would drink like a fish.
Sure.
I'd spend crazy amounts of money at really crappy restaurants. And I just would do outrageous things. And I got a little help for that, but then I was like, oh, this is lame. I don't need help for this. And then I got deployed my second time, and that's when all the problems that happened with my first tour kind of came to a head.
Sarah says nobody knew anything was wrong. She suffered alone, but got through her second tour.
After my second tour, I was pretty messed up, and I would have therapy 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just say, well, just make it to the next therapy, and then just make it to the next therapy. And then I got to this point where it's just like, well, this is dumb.
So she stopped going to therapy and decided she was better off dead.
I have this little Jack Russell. His name's Charlie.
Charlie Crazy Hairs.
Charlie Crazy Hairs. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't kill myself because I didn't want him to eat my body. And I knew nobody would check on me. I lived by myself. Nobody would check on me.
Do you want to kind of like describe like what it was like trying to just make it day to day? I mean, that's no way to live.
Oh, it was horrible. There was times where I didn't even get off the couch. I remember when I got my cable turned on at my apartment, and I was just like, yes, I have something to do, because I had cable and internet. So that was 2 other things. So I have Charlie, cable, and internet.
Right.
That's 3 things on my side.
Yeah.
And that was just enough motivation to at least make it to the beginning of the school year.
Yeah.
And I knew that I had to do something.
Yeah.
Either suicide or get better.
Right.
It came to that climax, that pinnacle point.
And like that's a brutal point to be at.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
on or off.
Yep.
And like a light switch.
It's do or die.
Over time, Sarah came to realize that her story was important to share.
Every time I talk about it, more and more female vets come up to me and like, oh, I experienced the same thing.
Yeah.
And it just amazes me how many females have experienced this and yet nobody's talking about it.
Yeah. No, it's as big an epidemic as this.
Because I felt crazy for a really long time. Like, oh, it's just me. Oh, I'm being a sensitive female. And I can joke with the best of them. To realize that this many females are going through it, and it's not just a sensitive female thing, but it's for reals.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It happens to men, too. And this is something that we really need to get to light. There is nothing wrong with the victims of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
We're sexual harassment. And we just kind of got used to victim blaming in our society because I have no idea why we got used to it. We just had to blame somebody.
According to the VA, at least 1 in 4 female veterans are victims of military sexual trauma. Victims may experience depression, trouble sleeping, difficulty staying focused, problems with alcohol or other drugs, difficulties in relationships, feeling isolated, or disconnected from other people.
There is this pressure to do things and this pressure to provide certain favors for people in order to get that promotion or in order to get not put on detail again.
Right.
I can't tell you how many times I got put on guard duty because they didn't want me around. They moved my job several times because they didn't want me around because I wouldn't sleep with them.
Right.
And it's hard. And once you come to that point where you realize it, like, hey, I'm not banging them and that's why I'm getting treated like this, that doesn't make sense. We're cool back home, why aren't we cool here? But I mean, I don't know the solution to that.
What would you say to a female in the military or a female veteran that was
You're not alone. You're not crazy. You don't have to do this alone. Just get help. Nobody's gonna judge you. Period. You don't have to be judged. You don't have to judge yourself. You can grow from it.
Right. Now, what would you like, if you had you have the stand right now, you're at the podium, what would you say to the civilians who have never went into the military, who are, one, they're struggling to understand us. I mean, they want to help us.
Yeah.
But what would you say to them about everything that we've talked about, the military sexual trauma, the suicide problem?
I think that it's a problem that we as soldiers have a hard time understanding ourselves. And sometimes when you go to combat or you're in these situations where there's military sexual trauma, you just have to deal with it the best way you know how.
Right.
That's what we're doing. We're trying to deal with it and be okay the best way we know how. And sometimes it just takes that ear. Sometimes it just takes that shoulder. Sometimes it's just, hey, I'm here if you ever want to talk.
That was Army veteran Sarah Lifeheit speaking with Mark Combs on a West Virginia Public Broadcasting documentary called Still Taking Casualties. Like Sarah, Jeremy Harrison is another veteran who's working to try to help his fellow veterans. He was the 4th veteran to speak during the Still Taking Casualties live event. Here's what he said when he first took the stage.
You know, I just want to say, before we get started, I'm sitting here listening to these stories, and I think the coolest thing out of what each one of them had to say is that right now, they're all going to school to do something that's going to allow them to help other veterans.
And Jeremy says his experience in war taught him this fundamental truth about what it means to support your brothers and sisters. It was 2003. Jeremy was one of the engineers who helped build a bridge into Baghdad, as Marines moved across the Diyala River and onto southern Baghdad.
We came up and we built a bridge, a floating bridge on the river, under fire. It was the first bridge since World War II to be built under fire. We were taking heavy artillery and small arms. You know, it's pretty neat that it's become a historic event and it's written about a lot, but it was very scary when it was going on.
Oh,
you know, we had security, we had the Marine Corps securing us. and several of them died that day.
Jeremy says he wears bracelets to honor the Marines who died alongside him during the invasion of Baghdad. They protected him. They watched over each other. Things changed that day for the soldiers who survived.
We learned that we only had each other to depend on, mm-hmm. and that became huge for us.
Right.
There was nobody else around. At that time, nothing really was set up. Mm-hmm. So we had to rely upon one another. And we realized how important that was when we left.
And then, about 9 months later, they sent him home, back to their families, and back to the United States.
We all went our separate ways. We didn't see each other again for 3 months. Mm-hmm. But you know, we just spent a lot of time drinking, partying, trying to figure out who we were and what the hell happened and why we couldn't sleep at night anymore and why everybody got on our nerves and why we couldn't have a relationship with anybody. And we just wanted to push everybody away and stay in our safe environment that we could protect.
In those first few months when they were separated, Jeremy says there were a few men in his company who attempted suicide. Meanwhile, Jeremy got a job working for the Vet Center in Morgantown, West Virginia. He got his master's degree in social work at WVU, and he worked as a therapist, helping veterans who were dealing with PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder.
We need to find a mechanism that allows the veterans to better take care of one another. Sure. I don't know what that is. I have some ideas, but I'm not really sure how we can make that work, but that's what we need. We need there are so many veterans that want to take care of each other.
Right.
And we need to find a mechanism for that to happen.
Still, for Jeremy, helping work closely with fellow veterans did take an emotional toll on him. It both healed and hurt him mentally. Over time, it got worse.
You know, it was good for me. It was good for me. It was healing for me to be able to help other veterans that were dealing with their stuff. But it was killing me inside. I almost didn't get here. You know, I had a suicide attempt myself. And somehow I lived through it. Nobody could understand how I made it, but I did. And, you know, it was hard. The pressure of working with vets day in and day out and doing all that, I exhausted myself.
And as he heard more and more stories from the trauma that other veterans were dealing with, he began reliving not just his own war experiences, but their stories crept into his nightmares too. He calls his own attempted suicide a wake-up call. He needed a change. He wanted to continue to help veterans, but he knew he couldn't keep helping in the way that he had been as a therapist. So he and his wife founded a nonprofit to help veterans in rural Marshall County. It's called Helping Heroes, and it's funded in part by a VA grant. They provide support services, and they partner with the health clinic in Wheeling to provide medical services to veterans. They also help refer them to therapy. Helping Heroes also provides transitional living for homeless veterans who are dealing with substance abuse and mental health issues.
I mean, we had a guy not long ago that walked in, same age as me, homeless, living on the streets, and that night he was sleeping in his own apartment, in his own bed.
He says the problems in rural areas make it especially difficult for veterans to access mental health providers during weekends.
Where are they going to go on Saturday night after they've been drinking? They can go to a local hospital, but it's not prepared to deal with them. Mm-hmm. They can't get to Pittsburgh in most cases. Maybe some have a friend that'll take them, but they can't get there. So, you know, there needs to be an increase in transportation capability, opportunity in local areas. Where we are, vets have, especially with the population that we work with at Helping Heroes, they don't have a way to get anywhere.
Jeremy says he and his wife are working on developing a system to offer transportation to the VA in Pittsburgh for veterans who need specialized care. His project is an example of more nonprofits that are being developed, partially in partnership with the VA, to connect veterans with mental health care even when they live in rural areas. As we mentioned earlier in our program, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs released a report last month with new statistics on veterans who've died by suicide. The information they uncovered shows that these rates are still high, especially among younger veterans and veterans who are over 50 years old. But the report also presents some hopeful insights. Caitlin Thompson, is the National Director for Suicide Prevention with the VA, and she joined me by phone to talk about how her agency is working to reach out to more veterans in need.
And what we really do know is that when someone is feeling suicidal or when someone is starting to feel like they're at their end of their rope, treatment works. People get better. People move on in their lives, and they lead really high-quality, productive, wonderful lives. But they just need that intervention to get them to that point, and VA is always here for that.
The VA study doesn't include state-by-state information. That data may be released later this year. Thompson says one of the biggest challenges the VA has in trying to prevent suicides is that it's hard to connect or reach out to veterans who don't use VA care.
There are quite a few veterans who die by suicide who have never touched VA care, and I think that a lot of those veterans are in rural areas.
The recent study by the VA shows that veterans in rural areas are more likely to commit suicide than veterans in urban areas. Part of the problem may be, like Thompson said, because rural areas often don't have a VA clinic or hospital that's easily accessible. But they don't know all the reasons, and it may just be that people in rural areas are less likely to seek help from a mental health provider. So for veterans who live far away from a VA hospital or clinic, what are their options if they want to seek help? Just an example of one program that's being developed, the VA is putting more resources into what's called a telemental health hub and spoke program, which is prioritizing veterans who live in rural areas. How it works is mental health providers in Pittsburgh and Charleston, South Carolina, can see patients in West Virginia through a video conferencing system. Gina Capra is the director of the Office of Rural Health at the Veterans Administration. She says her office has connected 15 spoke sites at veteran centers across West Virginia.
Because I think we recognize that there were rural access challenges in West Virginia, and so it was prioritized as one of the places that we wanted to try to stand up this service sooner rather than later.
So the VA is trying to help veterans in rural areas, and part of the solution is collaboration with nonprofits. Still, they admit there's a lot of work to do. Today on our show, we've been hearing from veterans sharing their stories about the difficult transition back to civilian life. A lot of the voices we heard were from a documentary called Still Taking Casualties. It was produced by West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Chip Hitchcock and his friend Mark Combs, a veteran himself. The documentary was filmed earlier this year as a live event with an audience. You can watch the entire hour-long program online at wvpublic.org. There were lots of folks who helped put the documentary together. Tyler Burrows was one of Mark's closest friends, and he helped as a consultant for the documentary. He also worked with West Virginia Public Broadcasting on an app that allows veterans to share their stories. It's called The War in My Words. After Mark hosted Still Taking Casualties, Tyler sent Sarah Leifheit this message on Facebook.
After I did the Still Taking Casualties, Tyler said, "Sarah, you are such an amazing person. You got massive balls, too." I'm so humbled after watching you on PBS. And I said, "Thank you so much. We need to get together soon." He said, "Damn right. We need to take better care of each other since no one else seems to want to. If you know, if you ever need anyone, I'm here."
Mark Combs and Chip Hitchcock produced this story about Tyler Burrows.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Amen. All right. This is, yes, a time for sadness, but it's also a time for celebration as we celebrate Tyler's life.
Why should I feel discouraged?
Tyler Burrows was a combat infantryman in Iraq from 2009 to 2010. He shot himself this July. Tyler's memorial service was packed with veterans, friends, and family. Jeremy Rodriguez was one of those vets. His Stryker armored vehicle was hit by a roadside bomb in Iraq. He was the only survivor. Tyler's platoon was the first to arrive on the scene. They pulled Jeremy from the Stryker and put him on a medevac helicopter. Jeremy is in a wheelchair now, so he caught a ride to Tyler's funeral from Lansing, Michigan, with other members of Tyler's platoon.
I love him. I mean, the bond that we made, it can't be broke. I can't explain the way it feels when I'm with my civilian friends. Tyler and I, we shot the basically online most of the time because he lived here and I lived there, and I have my life and my family. But if there's anything that I could have done, I would have done.
No one saw Tyler's suicide coming. Like most folks, Tyler had plans for vacationing, probably Mexico next summer. To save up for it, he was going to Deep Creek Lake in Maryland this summer. He had just been promoted to sales manager at Kingwood's Victory Chrysler and Jeep. His mom, Marcia, talked about why he was such a good salesman.
You know, I can shake your hand, I can look you in the eye. Tyler was sincere and authentic, and his genuine goodwill towards people made them respond to him as a salesman. Yeah, I mean, when people would buy their Jeeps, I don't know if you saw it on his webpage, he would post a picture on the dealership and thank them for their purchase and wish them well with their car. And he meant it. I mean, he did that once, and I ended up, I sent him a text and I said, do you have a marketing person who taught you to do this? And he goes, nope, it was my idea.
He was helping people. And that's what Tyler loved to do more than anything, is that he loved the opportunity to help someone.
That's Iraq War veteran and Tyler's friend, Mark Combs.
Tyler took personal interest in every one of his customers. You know, he would call me on his drive home and be like, man, I had this veteran come in and he didn't have good credit, but I got him in a fucking car. He's proud of it. It was a good car.
But the war deeply affected Tyler. Some of his veteran friends got together to talk about him. Mark Combs was one of them. Sarah Leifheit was on still taking casualties. And Derek Bolden was a Marine machine gunner who deployed twice. Derek said Tyler was angry about what he had done.
We have overthrown governments because they didn't fit our ideas and they didn't subscribe and buy into what America was. Mm-hmm. Tyler knew that. Mm-hmm. And it's a question that all of us ask ourselves.
Yep.
Why did we do that? Why did we participate? That's what makes us so angry.
Yeah, and disillusioned.
What the were we doing? We lost friends and family.
We've seen
our friends
kill themselves after everything.
In awful situations. Because it was beneficial to our bottom line. Mm-hmm.
Marcia and John Burroughs, Tyler's parents, had no idea he was hurting so badly. John says it was all good until it wasn't. One night, he and Marcia went to a Jimmy Buffett concert with Tyler and his friends. Jimmy thanked the veterans for their service, and John describes Tyler's reaction.
He balled up. He was on the ground is where we found him. And we then left the concert right then because he'd lost all control. He's crying and screaming a little bit, saying some crazy things about, he's a sick person. He's not well, and so we went home, and the rest of the night was spent listening to him cry and scream and yell about the loss of his friends and why. And it's the first time as a parent that I've not been able to really help somebody put a Band-Aid or whatever on it. All we could do is listen.
Like many combat vets, Tyler was deeply troubled by the loss of his friends' lives and what he had done in Iraq. Tyler killed people, but he didn't talk about it to many of his friends. Mark says Tyler told Mark these stories, but even now, Tyler wouldn't want Mark to talk about them. Instead, Mark tells a story about what he did in Baghdad that was similar to Tyler's stories.
There was a man driving, but in the back seat was a woman and two children, and I had no choice but to shoot the vehicle. And, that's something that I live with, and that's something that I have never told, my aunt and uncle or my grandfather or anybody, but
Mark says combat soldiers are trained to close with and destroy the enemy, or die trying. They talk about death day and night. Mark could have been killed many times in Iraq, as bullets flew past his head, or he exchanged his place in a convoy with a vehicle that then got hit by an IED.
And if you've ever seen combat, you've become somewhat more comfortable with death. Because you had to. You had to survive, to get past it. I think there, because of that familiarity, the idea of suicide isn't as troubling to you as it would be somebody who hasn't gone through those things.
The New York Times reports that no one knows whether combat vets kill themselves more frequently than non-combat vets. That statistic isn't tracked. Mark believes that when the fighting is over and they return home, vets can get into a rut thinking about what they did right or what they did wrong.
There was plenty of times where, you know, Tyler and I spent time with one another because the other one was, you know, in one of those ruts thinking about something. I mean, there's so much stuff that a infantryman or any soldier or any military person can go through over there that are going to affect them a million different ways from anybody else, and it's just tough. And it's hard, and you might not ever get better. You might not ever forget. You might not ever get past it.
Totter's good friend and Marine Derek Bolden is also traumatized by the war and understands how Totter could have taken his life.
And I happen to know from experience that once I get so mad and so frustrated that, God damn the consequences,
mm-hmm.
I just need to let go. I went through it today, even. I got angry. And I started to hurt myself. It happens, and it escalates quickly, before you know it. And if you're alone, and you're tired, and you're drunk, and the one person you can reach out to does not respond, you just kind of fall. You have no one to talk to, no one that... Not that you don't try to talk to someone, it's just that you're so mad so quickly.
Even if
it just happens.
Even if you could connect, you don't want to.
It just happens so fast that before you can stop, it's too late.
Yep.
Sarah Leifheit earned her master's in social work after returning from Iraq and adds to Derek's theory.
There's something else at the base of anger. And when you have that anger and that sadness, it's just too overwhelming sometimes. And you just see that as your only option. And that's what suicide is. It's a temporary solution to a permanent... It's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. There it is. And...
But it becomes not your problem.
It's no longer your problem.
The Veterans Administration now says 20 vets a day kill themselves. But Totter wasn't a statistic. He was a real person, with family, childhood friends, and veteran buddies. The other 19 vets are just as real. Mark says that if we listen to their stories, maybe so many won't become statistics.
You can't go into war and come out unscathed in one way or another. There's damage done to everyone there. The stories that really need to be told are not, you know, the glazed over, you know, mittens story. They're the stories that really hurt. And as far as your question, did Tyler have demons? Yeah.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Chip Hitchcock in Morgantown.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, you can call the VA Crisis Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. If you're a vet and you want to share your story, the application that Tyler helped to build is now available. It's called War in My Words. It's a place where vets can record and share their stories wherever they are. The mobile app and website are also designed to help vets connect with each other. That's War in My Words. We just heard some personal stories from veterans who thought about ending their life. The struggle for vets to find a purpose. And we heard the story of another veteran, gone. Now, we end the show with a little hope and explanation. Eric Newhouse is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of a book called Faces of Combat, PTSD and TBI. When I spoke with Eric, he explained that it's important to talk about trauma, but there's a scientific explanation why sometimes that's the hardest thing to do. I noticed in several of the articles the term moral injury, and this is something that's new to me. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Moral injury is a concept that's really arrived in the last 5 or 6 years. It's not recognized by the AMA yet, and it's not part of the official diagnosis of PTSD, but it should be. PTSD is typically a fear factor. It's something that you respond to people trying to kill you, and ultimately, over time, that hyperarousal becomes a permanent factor. It's with you even when you come back from the combat zone. But the moral injury factor, which I like to call the wounded soul syndrome, is the opposite of it. It's not having someone do something to you, but it's all about what you did to others or what you failed to do for others. And that is unrecognized largely, but it's a very real component. It prevents vets from talking to each other about what they've done. It prevents them from talking to their families about what they've done. They bottle things up, and ultimately they realize that they can't handle that anymore. They come apart, and they may very well commit suicide.
What do you think we need to know about the term moral injury to where we might be able to help maybe prevent a suicide? What do we need to know?
We need to know that it's prevalent. I was in Philadelphia and spoke on a panel with Bessel van der Kolk, and Bessel was talking about revenge killings. He said they're not common, but they are common enough that that there's a term for them. For instance, a guy whose buddy got killed in combat the day before may go out, shoot up a village, kill some men, kill some children, rape a woman, and feel momentarily better about what he'd done. But when he comes back home again, then he's got to live with that. And he may not trust himself anymore. He may not trust himself around his wife and children. He isolates himself. We have to find ways to allow those vets to talk freely about what they've done. They need to make atonement for what they've done. They need to forgive themselves for what they've done. And ultimately, they need to experience other experiences, whitewater rafting, for instance, which gives you a huge rush of adrenaline, and which is, nobody's trying to kill you, it's just a river that may very well kill you. So those experiences can replace the images of combat. Our brain, we know to be a plastic brain, and as you are able to layer other more beneficial images over some of the trauma that's underneath it, you alleviate that trauma.
Another article that I read, you talked about sexual trauma, and on this show we heard from a victim of military sexual trauma and how common apparently that is within the military as well. And talk a little bit about the type of betrayal that happens and how, you know, again, we might be able to help prevent those who are struggling with a military sexual trauma and what we need to know to help prevent a suicide.
MST is a terrible form of betrayal because when you are in combat, you are dependent upon your fellow soldier. He's your brother. You watch his back, he watches your back. But then if you're a woman and the guy whose back you were supposed to be watching gropes you or rapes you, you really feel that you are terribly alone and in hostile territory, and that one of the hostile people is one of your teammates. So it's a huge sense of betrayal. And that really becomes a sense of moral injury as well. Moral injury occurs when when you feel that you're in danger and you've been betrayed. And that's precisely what these women feel.
But it seems like, you know, over and over again, we hear about these things, but there's in this torture that our vets are struggling with even after they come home. But there are a lot of nonprofit organizations and people out there who are trying to raise awareness and trying to help. And it seems like and trying to put out the message that there is hope. What kind of hope would you say is out there for veterans that might be struggling?
You are right when you say that there are a lot of people who really care and who are trying very hard to help. Yeah, and that's a wonderful thing. That's a comforting thing. I think that there is hope for vets. I think that, first of all, they need to be able to talk about what they've been through, both the good and the bad. But the problem is that brains that have been traumatized are not susceptible to reason. When you are traumatized, your brain reverts to the amygdala, the limbic fight-or-flight syndrome. And so reason doesn't really have anything to do with how you perceive your situation or how you hope to get out of it. When the prefrontal cortex shuts down, your rational brain shuts down, an area called the Broca's area also shuts down. That area is responsible for speech. And when you lose that ability to speak about what you've been through, you can't process it either. And so that memory remains alive. It remains as though that happened to you just instants ago. And every time you revisit that, it's as though you're living it again for the first time. One of the ways that some people have found to get past that inability to speak about what they have been through is by writing. I have a friend, Lieutenant Colonel Bill Edmonds, who was in charge of Iraqi interrogators just outside of Baghdad. And he had a terrible time with the interrogators who really wanted to use physical force on what they considered to be the insurgents. He wouldn't let them because he knew that some of them were innocent. And he had to stand up for innocent people. Ultimately, he lost that battle and walked away from the interrogators and felt awful about it, had a huge sense of moral guilt. Then he discovered that some Iraqis had been tortured, and he suspected that they were tortured by his Iraqi interrogators. And so he reported the incident. The military investigated it and cleared everyone. And he was devastated. He felt as though he had been betrayed by his own government, and that he himself had betrayed his government and everyone around him. About 5 years later, he had a moral collapse. He went to see a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist asked him, had he been in combat? Had anyone been shooting at him? Did he have PTSD? He said, yeah, he thought he had PTSD, but he'd never been in combat. He'd never been shot at. And the psychiatrist told him, no, you don't have PTSD. Get a grip, go home, and work on it. Well, he basically did. He got up at about 2 or 3 in the morning every morning, went down to the kitchen table with a yellow legal pad, and began writing everything down that that had happened to him. He wrote it word by word by word. It struggled to get out, but he finally got it out. And he published it as a book, which is called God Is Not Here. It's a remarkable book, and it just is gut-wrenching because it comes directly out of Bill's gut. But writing in that way is hugely therapeutic because it allows you to talk about what you have been through. Finally, and once you've done that, you can process it and put it back behind you.
That's the story that you talked about in your blog
and the entry's called One Soldier's Struggle with Torture, Trauma, and Moral Injury.
Yeah. I think the one thing that's important to me is that soldiers need to know that they have to talk about what they've been through. They have to make atonement for what they've done. And in some cases, you know, that can be something like building schools or helping kids or community service, ways that they can give back to the world what they took away from it. After they've made atonement, they have to be able to forgive themselves, and they have to learn to play and build good memories that will replace the bad ones. I think if they can do that, they can recover.
Eric Newhouse, author of the blog Invisible Wounds, thank you so much for your time.
Jessica, thank you. It's been a privilege and a pleasure.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eric Newhouse. Eric is also the author of a book called Faces of Combat, PTSD and TBI. Eric tells us he's in the process of writing a new book called Faces of Recovery. Again, if you or someone you know is in crisis, there is hope. You can get better, and you are not alone. You can call the VA Crisis Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. If you're a vet and you want to share your story, the application that Tyler helped to build is now available. It's called War in My Words, and it's a place where vets can record and share their stories wherever they are. The mobile app and website are also designed to help vets connect with each other. Special thanks to Chip Hitchcock and Mark Combs for their work on Still Taking Casualties, a one-hour documentary you can watch on our website at wvpublic.org. Music in today's show was provided by Dylan McGonigal and Michael Hitchcock. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editors this week were Catherine Moore and Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.